let's assume that the president really was guilty of some underlying crime, and he fired Jim Comey only because he was afraid that Comey was going to figure out what that crime was. In my view, he's allowed to do that because he has the authority as president to do it. And I base that on, I know it's not exactly on point, but I base it on the Arthur Anderson case. In my reading of the cases, I understand there's a different view. Really, it's never been definitively decided in this context, but that makes a big difference, that Mueller appears to have a very broad view of obstruction. Otherwise, why would you be asking people about what did you mean when you said this to Jim Comey, or what was your motivation for asking Jeff Sessions to reverse his recusal? So that's what I see as a potential problem with McGahn, is that he was sent in based on an analysis of the case by the original lawyers that was probably correct with respect to collusion / conspiracy, but may not be with respect to obstruction.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 25th, 2018. Bob Mueller and the president's legal team are engaged in an extended negotiation over whether the president will sit for an interview with the Mueller team. As it turns out, there are three people in the world who have interviewed a sitting president as part of a grand jury investigation. This week, Benjamin Wittes sat down with one of them, Solomon Weisenberg. Weisenberg served as deputy independent counsel under Ken Starr during the Whitewater-Monica Lewinsky investigation. On Thursday, Weisenberg discussed his experience interviewing Bill Clinton, how that can inform thinking on the next possible presidential interview, and how both prosecutors and the president's lawyers can think strategically about next steps. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 341, Solomon Weisenberg on interviewing the president.
So, Sol, start by walking us through how you came to be interviewing the president of the United States for a grand jury.
Well, I worked for Ken Starr, who was the independent counsel investigating Whitewater and then the Monica Lewinsky case. And I was chosen along with two other prosecutors to conduct the grand jury questioning of President Clinton. We had initially subpoenaed him to the grand jury. He asked us to withdraw it and said that he would come and testify if we withdrew it, and so we did. The actual testimony took place in the White House and was piped into the grand jurors.
All right, so there's a lot there. Let's unpack it. First of all, with the current president now in negotiations with Bob Mueller for a possible interview, people will want to understand why the sequence, a subpoena, the president's agreement to appear, but only voluntarily, a withdrawn subpoena, and then the appearance. How did that happen, and why did the White House care whether the president appeared pursuant to subpoena or voluntarily?
Well, it started out when the Paula Jones / Monica Lewinsky scandal erupted. The president said he would cooperate with us and he would do so sooner rather than later. We sent him six letters through his attorney asking him to speak to us, and we were basically blown off. And so we issued a grand jury subpoena. The reason why he didn't want to appear pursuant to a subpoena, I guess, was because it would look embarrassing to him to be forced to come and testify. That's what a subpoena is. You know, it's a directive to come testify, and he didn't think that would look good. He also may have wanted to protect the prerogatives of the presidency. That may have been part of it.
So you said that you, when there was finally an agreement, you guys went to the White House. There were some significant accommodations made to the president. Describe them. So you were over there. He was not brought before a grand jury. If memory serves, there was a time limit, and his counsel were present, all of which are different, right?
Yes, I think there were too many accommodations made to the president. I was not personally involved in the negotiations over the ground rules, but we were confined to 4 hours. It's very easy for somebody like President Clinton to use up a lot of that 4 hours by answering every question with a speech. And I didn't think there should have been a time limit on it. And I think he should have marched himself over to the grand jury like any citizen would. And as you pointed out, because it was not at the grand jury, there had to be some special arrangement made. And so we piped it in. And also, his attorneys were allowed to be present, though they did not make objections or act like attorneys typically do, but they were allowed to be present.
So what is different about interviewing, doing a grand jury interview with a president than any other witness? I mean, you're one of three people living today, and maybe who's ever lived, who has had the experience of doing a grand jury and investigation that involved a sitting president directly enough to actually sit down with that president and conduct an interview. And certainly the fact that that interview video became public is a unique event. So it's different from talking to other witnesses, but how is it different?
Well, it's the president of the United States. Like you said, it's not every day that that happens. It's extremely historically rare. But the funny thing is, Ben, I didn't really have time to think about that or worry about it because I didn't know that I would be involved in the questioning until about 2 or 3 days beforehand. The original plan was that Bob Bittman, a fellow deputy, would do all of the questioning. And Judge Starr changed his mind 2 or 3 days before the testimony. And so I was so focused just on the task at hand, doing the portion of the examination that was assigned to me, that I felt like I feel in any situation where I'm preparing at the last minute for litigation.
Did you ever dream that that video would become public?
Well, I'm a skeptical type, and I certainly thought there was a chance that that video would see the light of day. And I thought there was a chance that our full referral later to the Judiciary Committee would see the light of day. And I was right on both counts.
One of your colleagues in that office, Brett Kavanaugh, is now a nominee to be on the Supreme Court. And as I'm sure you've seen, there's been a controversy over a memo that he wrote suggesting what the nature of the questioning should be. So we don't do judicial nominations at Lawfare, and I don't want to get into the Kavanaugh nomination. But I'm interested in the process that you guys went through in thinking about, you know, given the nature of the material in question, given the possibility that things would become public and the certainty that you guys would have to resolve certain, you know, questions in public. How did you guys think about what questions were and weren't appropriate to ask?
Well, the big debate that we had within the office was whether or not to treat the examination as a direct examination or a cross-examination. You know, you can do either in the grand jury or do a combination of the two. There were some people in the office who thought we had questions that we had to have answered, that we should do it in a very open-ended way. And there was another group that felt very strongly, based upon what we already knew about the president's conduct, that it should be like a cross-examination. But even the group that wanted to do a cross-examination believed in being very respectful of the president. And of course, we were very respectful.
Fast forward now the better part of 2 decades. And Bob Mueller, you read for the first time that Bob Mueller wants an interview with President Trump. What was your reaction?
Well, my initial reaction was President Trump's going to have to give that interview, because if he doesn't, Mueller will subpoena the president. And under U.S. versus Nixon, he'll ultimately have to testify. When I started looking at all the case law again, I realized that it's actually not that straightforward, that Mueller doesn't have the range of powers that Ken Starr had, or even that Leon Jaworski and Archibald Cox had, and that it was by no means a slam dunk that if Mueller took President Trump into court, that he would be allowed to litigate the question of executive privilege, or that he would prevail if he was allowed to litigate that question. We weren't worried about that back then. We we didn't have any doubt that we would win that battle.
Do you doubt that if Mueller were to issue a subpoena parallel, similar to the one that you guys issued, leave aside the question of whether the president could assert any privileges, that the subpoena would be considered enforceable and binding on the president and there would have to be some kind of interview?
Well, I think it would be binding and enforceable, but I believe that this position taken by Rudy Giuliani that you can't issue a subpoena to the president is preposterous and is not historically accurate. But I do believe that the president could then invoke executive privilege in an effort to challenge that subpoena. And I'm not at all certain that Bob Mueller would win that battle.
And why do you think that, I mean, there's statutory differences between Mueller and Starr and some regulatory differences between Mueller and Jaworski, but why do you think that those differences might rise to a magnitude that a subpoena enforceable by the court when Starr issued it would not be enforceable or might not be enforceable when Mueller issues it?
Well, I think the better comparison is not Starr and Mueller, but Jaworski and Mueller, because it may be that I was just delusional back then in thinking that we wouldn't have any problem winning such a battle. But Leon Jaworski, as part of his charter, which was enshrined in a regulation, was given the specific authority to litigate questions of executive privilege. And if you read any of the books on Watergate, the thing that worried Jaworski the most was that a court would say, Mr. Jaworski, you're an inferior officer of the president. This is a non-justiciable intra-branch dispute, and you're not allowed to even be here. But the Supreme Court brushed that aside because of that regulation. They said, hey, there's a regulation here. The president has not rescinded that regulation. And we don't have that here because I look at Bob Mueller's charter. I look both at the regulation and at Rod Rosenstein's grant of authority. I don't see that Bob Mueller has the authority to litigate questions of executive privilege. So that's the first hurdle I see. The second hurdle is that in Nixon, you had a very narrowly drawn subpoena. There were two different tapes cases in the Watergate investigation. One involved Archibald Cox and did not go beyond the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and the other one, of course, resulted in U.S. versus Nixon. But in both of those cases, Cox and Jaworski knew exactly the tapes they wanted. They were able to establish the dates and the times of those tapes through White House logs and through testimony, and they were able to establish that almost certainly important and arguably criminal conversations took place in those conversations. And I'm not sure that Mueller has that kind of information. And here with President Trump, apparently based upon what I've seen in the press, Mueller wants to ask questions that go to the heart of presidential communications and decision-making. What were you thinking when you asked Attorney General Sessions to reverse his recusal? What were you thinking when you had this conversation with Jim Comey? And I think he would need to surmount a pretty high burden to be able to win there. I'm not saying it's impossible because we don't know everything that Mueller knows, but I think it's much different than the cakewalk that Jaworski had.
And do you think that this may be the reason that Mueller has been so slow actually to issue a subpoena? I mean, he seems to be tolerating from the president's legal team a very high degree of negotiating back and forth. There have been letters exchanged over months. He's done nothing, even as the president's team have made public representations about the nature of the status of their discussions, and I wonder if you may be describing part of the reason that actually it's less of a slam dunk in his favor if they litigate than people assume.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a key factor. he's been very tolerant. Normally, if you got the kind of response you got from somebody like President Trump, and particularly, as you point out, the public discussion of this by Mayor Giuliani, I think the prosecutor would say, end of story, get yourself to the grand jury. Here's your subpoena. And you don't have it here. And I think that's the primary reason. The other thing is that by waiting, Mueller is gathering more evidence. So he's putting himself in a stronger position, potentially, if he does have to go to court to say, look what I have now. And he can say to the public, look how incredibly patient I've been because of my respect for the office of the presidency. It's kind of what happened with Ken Starr. I don't know if you remember when the Secret Service tried to create a privilege so that we wouldn't be able to question any Secret Service agents. Ken was remarkably patient and tried negotiating with them for months and finally had enough. And when he did, we easily prevailed there.
So your first reaction when you read is that the president's position is absurd. Then as you study it further, you come to think it's less absurd. I'm curious about, there must be some feeling of deja vu here, right? I mean, that, you know, everybody who went through that period thought it was a kind of once in a lifetime situation. And here we are, only three presidents later, and there's a different special prosecutor who wants a different interview so that a different Saul Weisenberg can sit down again. I mean, there must be something that has you scratching your head there.
Well, actually, what I think about is, and this is ironic, given president's very inappropriate attacks on Bob Mueller, just like President Clinton's attacks on us were inappropriate and unfortunate. But what comes to mind for me immediately is how much more cooperative, irrespective of what he says, how much more cooperative President Trump has been in terms of making people available who work for him and not invoking executive privilege. As you know, Nixon invoked executive privilege constantly. But President Clinton and his employees did as well. A lot of that wasn't even known until after we filed our referral. But we were constantly having to litigate that. We'd have somebody at the grand jury and we'd ask a question and they'd invoke privilege. And we'd go up to Norma Holloway Johnson, the chief district judge who was running the grand jury, and we'd have that resolved. Sometimes it would take days or weeks to resolve. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, the person would be invoking it again. So I think, I don't know exactly what his motivation was, but I think he's to be commended for not having done that. I mean, look at Don McGahn. I would have killed to have 30 hours with Bruce Lindsay talking to him.
or Jane Sherburne's notes.
Right.
So, right. So let's talk about Don McGahn. On the one hand, I look at that and I say that was a colossal strategic misjudgment, right? That they let him go up there. They don't seem to have substantially debriefed him. They didn't use the possibility of privilege litigation to leverage any kind of terms or accommodations. And the other part of me says, remembering the Bruce Lindsay and Jane Sherburne litigations, that actually they wouldn't have had a leg to stand on if they'd resisted. And, you know, government attorney-client privilege doesn't exist in this context. And so Don McGahn was going to have to spend as much quality time with Bob Mueller as Bob Mueller wanted him to. Which is right?
Well, I think that I obviously agree with you on attorney-client privilege, but he could have invoked executive privilege. And the law in the D.C. Circuit, in resealed case, I don't necessarily agree with it, but it sets this pretty high burden. And again, it sets it in the context of presidential communications. And here, presidential personnel decisions, I think, would fall within that rubric. So I'm not at all clear, not at all sure, that it would have been a slam dunk for Mueller. Also, I think that Dowd, the original lawyers for the president, John Dowd and Ty Cobb, were focused on the collusion slash conspiracy case. And they looked at the evidence and they believed the president was pretty much in the clear there. So they didn't see a problem with sending McGahn in. The problem now is it looks like Mueller and his people have a very, very broad view of obstruction of justice. That's what makes the McGahn testimony, interview, whatever you call it, so potentially dangerous. You and I think, Ben, have a different view on obstruction. I think that it is not enough if you fire somebody and have a corrupt intent. For example, let's assume that the president really was guilty of some underlying crime and he fired Jim Comey only because he was afraid that Comey was going to figure out what that crime was. In my view, he's allowed to do that because he has the authority as president to do it. And I base that on, I know it's not exactly on point, but I base it on the Arthur Anderson case. And my reading of the cases, I understand there's a different view. Really, it's never been definitively decided in this context. But that makes a big difference, that Mueller appears to have a very broad view of obstruction. Otherwise, why would you be asking people about, what did you mean when you said this to Jim Comey, or what was your motivation for asking Jeff Sessions to reverse his recusal? So that's what I see as a potential problem with McGahn, is that he was sent in based on an analysis of the case by the original lawyers that was probably correct with respect to collusion slash conspiracy, but may not be with respect to obstruction.
There's another possibility, of course, which is that he was sent in with that understanding, but the aggregate obstruction fact pattern does not actually rely on a particularly broad theory of obstruction in order to have a serious question, right? Because the range of presidential activity in this area is pretty broad. And I keep wondering if you string it all together, whether there's a construction of the facts in which it doesn't require a particularly capacious theory of obstruction in order to have a cognizable offense.
Well, in the words of my favorite former president, let me say this about that. 9 times 0 is still zero. To me, if you have 9 events strung out, as you say, but neither of them, not one of them together equals obstruction, I have a hard time saying that all of them together do. However, all you need is one instance of classic obstruction.
Right.
All you need is one episode. So I think you're right in that sense. If you have one episode of what we think.
And then the rest of it comes in as pattern.
Right. And it also just comes in as evidence of intent. I mean, that's the tremendously dangerous thing about President Trump's inability to control himself, his incontinence, if you will, is that all of that can come in as evidence of his intent, either in an impeachment proceeding or after impeachment if he's indicted.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of it can come in as a conspiracy allegation, right? You know, as overt acts in a conspiracy to obstruct justice.
Absolutely. And as you know, an overt act doesn't in and of itself have to be criminal.
Exactly. And so, my point is I agree with you that it's very hard to see how even a corrupt firing of an official in and of itself is an obstruction. On the other hand, I don't think you have to have a lot of non-Article II authorized behavior that would constitute illegal obstruction before you have a very sort of self-righting conspiracy to obstruct justice allegation wherein some of the acts are themselves, in and of themselves, constitutionally authorized Article II powers of the president, but the aggregate pattern looks awful and contains enough stuff that isn't that I don't know that a court would say, well, the president gets to do paragraph 6 and the president gets to do paragraph 8 and the paragraph president gets to do paragraph 11. Therefore, we're scratching those off of the list.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. And I mean, an example I like to give of one, if you're looking for one obstructive act, potentially, I'm not saying it happened, But the famous drafting of the statement about the Trump Tower meeting a year later on Air Force One, what if the president has generally conceded that the president drafted a false press release? What if, while he was drafting it, he said to all the people who were gathered around, this is going to be our story going forward with everybody.
Right.
Okay, everybody, get it straight. This is our story with the press. It's our story with Mueller. It's our story with the Congress. That would be different. And, you know, a lot of these cases, I'm familiar with the Brookings Institution report on obstruction. It cites five or six appellate court cases that have language indicating that you can do something that in and of itself might be legal and it can be obstruction. And in almost all those cases, the defendant does some things that are clearly illegal and other things that are completely legal. There's a, I can't remember the name of the case, but there's a great one, a civil rights case, where the FBI is investigating corruption in the, I think, the county sheriff's office in Los Angeles. And they have an informant in there, and the county sheriffs figure out that the informant is an informant, and they do things like they move him. they disappear him. You know, they when the agents come to talk to him, they can never find him. And one of their responses was, of the defendant was, I'm allowed to do this. I can do whatever I want with my prisoners. As long as I'm not torturing them or anything, I can move them. That's part of my administrative powers. And the court looked at the entire course of conduct and said, well, maybe you can do that. But when you put all this together, you can't do it. And some of the things they put together involved deceit of the FBI. Well, that's different, right? If you are lying to a law enforcement officer, that is classic obstruction. So I think that all it takes is one or two things, only one thing, really, part of a course of conduct that constitutes classic obstruction. And then you've got a case, and then all that other stuff can come in to show, as you say, pattern, motive, all of that.
So let me ask you about one discrete act that I'm today particularly interested in. Yesterday, the president tweeted and in an interview gave active encouragement to Paul Manafort in not cooperating with a lawful federal investigation. And he conspicuously did not, you know, discourage the belief that he might entertain a pardon request. And he talked about how brave he was for not flipping and, you know, breaking. And the question is, in your judgment, could such public coaxing of somebody to not cooperate ever constitute witness tampering under 1512B?
Well, I think you could have public witness tampering. I'm not saying it's impossible. And certainly what the president said was just despicable. But I don't think that is enough. And one reason I don't think it's enough is because of his incredibly broad pardon powers and powers of clemency. I think that I disagree with people who say you could never have a witness tampering involving pardon. I think if you look at Nixon's conduct, their clemency was definitely held out specifically to the original Watergate burglars, and they were paid hush money. So I think if it's specific enough, it becomes witness tampering. The problem is the president's come very close, but I just don't think he's come close enough. It's to anyone who believes in the rule of law, it's very disturbing, but I just don't think it's enough.
Yep. So, all right, if you were the president's defense lawyer here, obviously, I assume you would try to keep him from conducting an interview. Is that a reasonable assessment?
Well, if I were the president's lawyer who was appearing on TV, I would make sure that I drank some coffee before I appeared on network TV, particularly if I had just been having dinner with some drinks. But if you're talking about advice to the president, this is the way if you take politics out of it completely, I don't know any white-collar attorney worth his salt or her salt who would advise somebody in the president's position to go in and talk to Bob Mueller. it would be professional malpractice.
Okay, so now step out of your capacity as a white collar defense person and talk as somebody who's had to interview a president and therefore has had to think about what the obligations of the president are, given that he's not just a white collar criminal subject, he's also the president of the United States. What are his obligations, in your view, when asked for an interview by Bob Mueller on the combination obstruction / collusion, Russian interference stuff?
Whose obligations? The president or his attorney?
No, the president. The attorney's obligation is to zealously represent his client's interest and advise him, don't do it, Mr. President, don't do it. It would be professional malpractice for me to let you do that willingly, et cetera, et cetera. I accept that's the attorney's role. What's the president's obligation here?
Wow. Well, I think the president has a duty to, I don't think there's any legal obligation, right? I just think as the chief executive, somebody who's supposed to be of a high moral character and somebody who is supposed to faithfully execute the laws, I think he wants to be in a position to say, yes, of course, I'll talk to you. I'm happy to talk to you.
If you were advising Bob Mueller's people now, what's the right play for them on the specific question of the interview? Do you just let it go and do what you're going to do without it? Do you litigate in order that you can say we did everything in our power to get the interview, or do you do something else?
I think your two choices are to either go ahead and issue the subpoena, and if it is challenged, clearly they've been making a record of all the efforts they've made to try to accommodate the president. In your court papers, which will be presumably under seal because it's a grand jury matter by that time, you set out for the court to see and maybe someday for history to see all the efforts you made to accommodate the president. The other option is to say to the is to basically say, all right, we've given you this deadline. You haven't met it. We don't need you. And you ultimately tell the public, we gave him every opportunity. We've been over backwards. He didn't come in, so we're going to proceed without him. And frankly, as you can see from our case, we didn't really need to talk to him.
Do you have an instinct as to which one they'll do?
Well, I look at the investigation. It's been a very, very aggressive investigation. They have indicted several people for not telling them the truth. And, you know, that's always a decision whether or not to do that. My feeling is that if you're going to be a special prosecutor, by definition, you have limited time. By definition, you're going to be attacked. And so you got to come in and instill fear in the minds and hearts of the people who you are investigating, in as much as you want to keep them from lying to you, and you want to send a clear signal, we're not here to be screwed with, don't lie to us. So I think that's the tack that Mueller's people have taken. Weissman has a well-deserved reputation as being an extremely aggressive, even overly aggressive prosecutor. So I look at that, and I believe that there will be a subpoena issued if the president will not agree to the interview.
Saul Weisenberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Enjoyed it.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks to Solomon Weisenberg for jumping on a call and chatting this week. Do us a favor and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. And while you're at it, tell your friends about the Lawfare podcast on Twitter, Facebook, on the phone, or in person. Our podcast was produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell. As always, thanks for listening.